WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPD LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, January 9th. A Sarasota judge dismissed a defamation lawsuit by the Trump Media Group against the Herald Tribune newspaper. The Sarasota-based business that controls the Truth Social platform sued the local newspaper last year for more than $100,000 over a column that was based on allegations made to another newspaper, The Guardian, by a fired Trump media executive. The judge dismissed the case against the Herald Tribune, saying the column was clearly marked as opinion. The judge did allow a Trump media lawsuit against The Guardian and other news outlets to continue if amended. A law targeting employers that hire undocumented workers is in the mix of the legislative session in Tallahassee that begins next week. Under SB 1380, Florida businesses that hire more than 50 undocumented immigrants could face big fines or even criminal charges. Purposely not using E-Verify could result in big fines or 5-year business license suspensions. Employers who file workers' comp claims for undocumented employees would be personally liable for any costs. And undocumented employees that cause injury or death can result in 6-digit fines or permanent revocation of the employer's business license. That bill was filed Wednesday. Also in the mix in Tallahassee, a bill that would ban diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives by local governments. SB 1134 would not only result in malfeasance charges against officials, but also open the door to lawsuits by individuals who allege they have been harmed by inclusionary hiring practices. This bill has received the enthusiastic endorsement of Governor Ron DeSantis. Due to tensions with the United States, Canadian homeowners are backing out of Florida. That's according to two real estate analysis firms. One recent study by Royal LePage concluded that 54% of Canadians who own real estate are planning to sell within the next year, and 62% of those blame Donald Trump. Meanwhile, a Realtor.com analysis says the number of Canadians looking for U.S. property declined 4.5% in the last quarter of 2025. Canadians are the largest group of foreign real estate owners in the Sunshine State. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Friday, January 9th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. Hope all had a happy new year, and hoping this year will be better than the last, but it seems many of the old issues will remain, and more bizarre turns of events will continue. I have to wonder why Jeffrey Epstein left such a paper trail with DOJ officials now claiming to have to examine 2 million pieces of evidence, such as it is, connected to him. That trove is reported to contain handwritten notes, photos, emails, and other communications that must be carefully examined to be sure that none of the victims of Epstein and his co-conspirators are being revealed. Seriously? If DOJ is so concerned about the 1,200 young girls exploited, why have no new charges been filed against those other child sex predators? Methinks some identities are being protected, but it's not the victims. Stay tuned until half past the hour to hear Steve Norris's conversation with author and former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who will break down the foreign policy implications of the kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife last weekend. But first, hear Jason Garcia's story, first published on Seeking Rents, revealing who is getting paid to provide slanted educational material to Florida schools. Seeking Rents, a newsletter and podcast devoted to producing original journalism, reports a for-profit children's education company connected to Trump appointee and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee wants more than $1 million from Florida taxpayers to develop lesson plans and instructional materials under a new law requiring Florida public schools to teach students about the history of communism. At the same time, an affiliate of the company has been donating tens of thousands of dollars to key lawmakers in Tallahassee, including the legislators in charge of writing the K-12 education budget in both the State House and Senate. The company has also retained a lobbying firm run by one of Governor Ron DeSantis's top political fundraisers. At issue is the proposed budget earmark that would steer $1.45 million in public funds to a faith-based education content company called eSpire. That money, budget documents show, would pay for a customized curriculum that Florida schools could use to comply with the 2024 state law, ordering them to provide instruction on communist history beginning in the 2026-27 school year. The mandatory lessons, which must emphasize the increasing threat of communism in the United States, will start in sixth grade and continue throughout middle and high school. Excerpts from the budget request that would earmark $1.45 million for eSpire. Based in Boca Raton, eSpire is perhaps best known for selling The Kids Guide, a series of explicitly partisan books about history and current events aimed at young children. Titles include The Kids Guide to How the Bible Built America, The Kids Guide to Media Bias and Fake News, and The Kids Guide to the Truth About Climate Change. A number of entries feature Republican politicians and conservative icons, including Donald Trump, Ronald Reagan, and Charlie Kirk. There's even a fawning entry focused on Ron DeSantis that was published back when the Florida governor was seen as a frontrunner for the Republican presidential nomination. The sticker price on that one has since been slashed from $21.99 to $1.99. See why parents everywhere are choosing the Kids Guide to teach their kids how to fight back against the liberal agenda, Huckabee, the former Arkansas governor and conservative media personality who now serves as Donald Trump's ambassador to Israel, says in one promotional plug. Kids Guide books are published by an affiliate of eSpire called Learn Our History, which Huckabee co-founded more than a decade ago with Brad Saff, a business partner and Florida-based investor. Learn Our History was launched first, and eSpire came along a few years later. Saff manages both Learn Our History LLC and eSpire LLC, according to corporate filings in Florida. Huckabee is the salesman. Former governor pocketed more than $60,000 in spokesperson fees from eSpire in 2024. According to federal financial disclosure, he had to file after being appointed ambassador to Israel. And while eSpire lobbies for money from Florida taxpayers, Learn Our History is handing money out to Florida lawmakers. A review of a finance campaign finance record shows that Learn Our History contributed at least $30,000 last month to fundraising committees associated with key leaders in the Florida legislatures. The company's gifts included $10,000 to Senator Jim Boyd, Republican from Bradenton, who is expected to become president of the Florida Senate after this year's elections, and $5,000 to Danny Burgess, Republican from Zephyr Hills, who chairs the Senate Pre-K through 12 Education Appropriations Committee. Learn Our Histories also gave $5,000 to Rep. Sam Garrison, Republican from Fleming Island, and Rep. Jennifer Canaday, Republican from Lakeland, who are in line to become Speaker of the House after the 2026 and 2028 elections, respectively. And it gave another $5,000 to Rep. Jenna Persons Malika of Fort Myers, who chairs the House Pre-K to 12 Budget Subcommittee. Of course, perhaps a company that unironically peddles the Kid's Guide to Fighting Indoctrination, a book that may be your last chance to prevent indoctrination of your children, Mike Huckabee says, is the perfect choice to design the curriculum for Florida's new History of Communism courses, which some independent historians have said seems designed to indoctrinate students rather than encourage critical thinking. The new courses will, among other things, emphasize the use of propaganda, including the repackaging of Marxist ideology in modern media and entertainment, the spread of Che Guevara t-shirts and communist iconology in popular culture, and the use of terms like McCarthyism and Red Scare to delegitimize anti-communists. Suncoast Searchlight reports on the news that neither Sarasota nor Manatee counties are buckling to charter schools. The following story was first reported by Suncoast Searchlight. Sarasota and Manatee County school districts have shut the door on Schools of Hope charter operators seeking space inside public campuses for now. Both districts denied the November 11th requests made by Mater Academy and Somerset Academy to co-locate inside four schools, Emma E. Booker Elementary in Brookside Middle in Sarasota, and the Sarah Scott Harley Center and Lincoln Memorial Middle in Manatee. The requests were among 700 filed statewide since last month by charter operators under the state's newly expanded Schools of Hope law, according to the Florida Policy Institute. In their denial letters obtained through public records request by Suncoast Searchlight, the districts argued that the plans were impractical, citing a variety of reasons for this, including lack of available space to accommodate charter students, lack of required infrastructure needed to support certain student populations, and the operators' failure to meet certain state requirements about how they would serve students from persistently low-performing schools. Sarasota County additionally noted in its denials that the recently approved repurposing of several campus buildings that allowed it to reduce those schools' student capacities, leaving no room for charters. Sarasota County School Superintendent Terry Connor denied Somerset Academy's bid to relocate inside two public schools because it's not an approved Schools of Hope operator. Under State Department of Education rules, either party can seek redress from the agency in cases where disputes asking that a special magistrate be appointed. The quasi-judicial process would give both the districts and charter schools a chance to make their case, with the magistrate recommending how to move forward. That recommendation would then be voted on by the Board of Education. The Department of Education did not respond to questions emailed by Suncoast Searchlight about whether the charter operators had submitted such a request. Neither charter school responded to emails seeking comments about the local denials. Sarasota School Board member Tom Edwards told Sarasota Searchlight that he does not believe a special magistrate has been requested or appointed. Jamie Carson, Director of Communications for Manatee County Schools, also said she was unaware of an appointment. All of this is unfolding under a major shift in Florida education policy. A controversial rewrite of the state's 2017 Schools of Hope law, pushed through the legislature earlier this year, no longer limits charter school operators from operating in chronically struggling campuses. Instead, it opens nearly every public school in the state with available space to potential co-location as a potential co-location and requires districts to shoulder much of the operational cost from transportation to custodial services. The expansion has ignited a fierce debate over who controls public school space, local districts, or Tallahassee. Edwards said the Schools of Hope legislation has a silver lining in that parents alarmed by its impact have become more engaged with the public education system. Parents are fired up and asking the right questions, he said. All these questions that I have been asking for the past 5 years. Finally, parents are understanding. Both Somerset and MATA have been linked to Academia, a major for-profit management company that works with more than 200 charter schools around the country, according to Academica's website. Academica said on its website that it sent hundreds of notices, but only plans to open a handful of schools for the 2027-28 school year. Holly Bullard, Chief Strategy Officer at Florida Policy Institute and the parent of a student in the Sarasota School District, called the move disruptive and disrespectful. How many hours of staff time and legal time have been spent on these notices for what Academica has admitted is a bluff, she told Suncoast Searchlight. Bullard said she was happy to hear that local school districts filed objections and that she has been impressed by Sarasota's response. These are school districts calling their bluff, she said of the local objections. I think it's a very strong response from the district that's been two steps ahead. Sarasota Superintendent Terry O'Connor wrote the denial letters for his district. Attorney Kevin W. Pendley wrote the ones for Manatee. Both cited material impracticality. The state rules on Schools of Hope legislation requires the district to base its objections on that term. The classroom at Sarasota Scott Harley Center provides access to education for students with significant physical challenges. The classroom has held a maximum of 10 students, which makes it appear underutilized, according to state-level reports called the Florida Inventory of School Houses. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Health insurance providers are still pretty cold-hearted. A 14-month-old boy who needed a potentially life-saving procedure suddenly had his insurance coverage cut. Megan Menendez of Ocala was left worried her son Shay might not get the care he needed. Menendez said, "They're just leaving me stuck. And I can't be stuck because my son's life is depending on it." Shay Menendez was scheduled for a stem cell transplant on January 5th, 2026, but about a month earlier, his mom learned the Medicaid coverage he had through Florida Department of Children and Families ended. It appears it had to do with his location. In May, Shay was sent to the Children's Hospital in Philadelphia in Pennsylvania because he needed specialized treatment. After his mom questioned his lack of coverage in December, she said DCF let her know that he had been out of state too long. Watching Shay Menendez interact with others, you might never know behind his curiosity and smiles, he is battling for his life. His mother said, "He's the most fun-loving, cuddly boy. He's very social." Megan Menendez said signs of trouble started 14 months ago, almost immediately after Shay was born. The medical team saw gas and fluid in his belly. Even a surgery didn't solve the problem. "He wasn't pooping. He was getting severely dehydrated. He wasn't eating," Menendez told Action 9 consumer investigator Jeff Deal. Nemours Children's Hospital in Orlando tried a few more procedures before full-scale genetic testing determined what he had, what's called FOXP3 mutation, which can cause a severe life-threatening autoimmune disorder. Menendez said it's a one-in-a-million genetic disorder or syndrome. With help from Nemours, they found Shea a bed in Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's receiving specialized treatment since May. His care was approved by insurance. Shea was under a Medicaid program with eligibility determined by the Florida Department of Children and Families. A few months ago, a stem cell transplant was scheduled for January 5th. In early December, Shea's family learned his Medicare coverage ended. November 30th, 2025, Mega Menendez asked DCF, said DCF told her that it was because her son had been out of Florida too long and she needed to apply in Pennsylvania, even though she and her husband are Florida residents. In mid-December, she told Action 9, "They're just giving me the runaround. I keep calling DCF, and I've called maybe 30 or 40 times over the past few days." She was worried it could put the planned procedure in jeopardy and ultimately put Shea's life in jeopardy. "It's really disheartening, and it's like my son doesn't matter and his life doesn't matter," she said. But after reaching out to Florida Congresswoman Kat Kamek, and Action 9 went to DCF with questions about it, she got some good news. She's covered. Shea's coverage was reinstated, which helped keep his potentially life-saving transplant on schedule. DCF told Action 9 that it would look into the situation, but so far hasn't explained why Shea's coverage was cut and later reinstated after his mom turned to Action 9. Mega Menendez said she's happy she doesn't have to worry about the insurance anymore and can just focus on being there for her son. Apparently, Shea Mendez is not the only one being mistreated by Medicaid. A federal judge this week ruled that Florida has violated the constitutional rights of people who were dropped from the Medicaid program because it sent notices to them that, quote, border on the incomprehensible. U.S. District Judge Marcy Morales Howard, in a 273-page ruling in a class-action lawsuit, also barred the state from terminating benefits of people for financial eligibility reasons unless it provides adequate notices. Howard wrote that people who received what is described as family-related Medicaid coverage are among the state's most vulnerable citizens. "They are primarily pregnant and postpartum women, infants, and children," she wrote. "And as to the evident, and as is evident from the applicable income standards, these individuals are the poorest of the poor. Prior to terminating the Medicaid benefits on which these individuals depend, the Constitution requires the state of Florida to provide them with adequate notice. The state of Florida is violating this constitutional requirement." In finding that the state violated due process rights, Howard wrote that the notices are vague, confusing, and often incorrect and misleading. She says people cannot understand the notices and whether the state made mistakes in denying them benefits. "This increases the likelihood that when the state makes an error, which is inevitable in a program of this size and complexity, impoverished parents, children, pregnant women, infants, will lose vital medical benefits for which they are eligible," the ruling said. "This causes tremendous harm not only to these individuals but to society at large. Indeed, it is the public interest to require the state to comply with its constitutional obligations and ensure that individuals eligible for Medicaid receive those benefits without interruption." Attorneys for people who had lost benefits filed a lawsuit in 2023 in Jacksonville, and Howard certified it as a class action in 2024. It applies to people who lost benefits after March 2023 or could lose benefits because of termination by the state that they do not meet income eligibility requirements for coverage. The lawsuit is rooted at least in part in 2023 end of the federal COVID-19 public health emergency. During the emergency, the federal government provided extra money to the state for Medicaid program with the caveat that the state would not drop people from the program. But after the emergency ended, the state began what is known as a redetermination process to review the continued eligibility of beneficiaries. Over the year-long period, the Department of Children and Families redetermined the eligibility of more than 4 million people, Tuesday's ruling said. Citing Department of Children and Families records, Howard wrote that 497,918,000 people were terminated from Medicaid based on income eligibility reasons between March 2023 and March 2024 and had not been reinstated as of March 2024. The lawsuit centered on the notices, but Howard's voluminous ruling also detailed problems related to issues such as decades-long state computer system and call center. The ruling said people who sought help and terminated benefits from the call center could have their calls blocked because of heavy volume, faced long wait times, or received erroneous information. It was not clear from this latest ruling how quickly the state could make changes or to provide adequate notice before terminating benefits, but Howard wrote that a constitutionally adequate notice must be unambiguously identify the state's decision to terminate full Medicaid benefits based on a finding of financial ineligibility, the person or persons to whom that decision applies, and the reasons for that decision. The reasons must be set forth in sufficient detail to allow the recipient to access the accuracy of the decision and decide whether to challenge the determination. Howard, however, rejected a request by the plaintiff's attorneys to reinstate the Medicaid program, people who have lost benefits or have not been reinstated. The state, however, will have to provide adequate notices to such people about why their benefits were terminated, which could lead to hearings about reinstatement. Now that Venezuela has been straightened out, Greenland's turn is coming up. The White House said this week that President Donald Trump is discussing options for acquiring Greenland, including potential use of U.S. military in a revival of his ambition to control the strategic island despite European objections. Trump sees acquiring Greenland as a U.S. national security priority necessary to deter our adversaries in the Arctic region, the White House said in a statement. The president and his team are discussing a range of options to pursue this important foreign policy goal, and of course, utilizing the U.S. military is always an option in the commander-in-chief's disposal, the White House said. Greenland has repeatedly said it does not want to be part of the United States. Leaders from major European powers and Canada rallied behind the Arctic territory on January 6th, saying it belongs to its people. The strong opposition has not deterred Trump from reviewing how to make Greenland a U.S. hub in an area where there is growing interest from Russia and China. Trump's interest, initially voiced in 2019 during the first term in office, has been rekindled in recent days in the wake of the U.S. arrest of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Emboldened by Maduro's capture last weekend, Trump has voiced his belief that American dominance in the Western Hemisphere will never be questioned again, and has put pressure on both Colombia and Cuba. He has also started talking about Greenland again after putting it on the back burner for months. A senior U.S. official speaking on anonymity to discuss internal deliberations said Trump and his advisors are discussing a variety of ways to acquire Greenland. Those options include outright U.S. purchase of Greenland or forming a compact of free association with the territory, the official said. The COFA agreement would stop short of Trump's ambition to make the land of 57,000 people part of the United States. Diplomacy is always the president's first option with anything, and deal-making. He loves deals. So if a good deal can be struck to acquire Greenland, that would definitely be his first instinct, the official said. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told lawmakers that the recent administration threats against Greenland did not signal an imminent invasion, or and that the goal is to buy the island from Denmark during a classified briefing late on January 5th for congressional leaders, two sources familiar with the briefing said. Members of Congress, including some of Trump's fellow Republicans, pushed back against the administration's conditions comments on Greenland. When Denmark and Greenland make it clear that Greenland is not for sale, the United States must honor its treaty obligations and respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of the Kingdom of Denmark, said Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire and Republican Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, the co-chairs of the Senate NATO Observer Group, said in a statement. Administration officials say the island is crucial to the United States due to its deposits of minerals important for high-tech and military applications. These resources remain untapped. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Up next is Steve Norris's conversation with Mel.
My name is Steve Norris, and you're listening to WSLR and WBPV. Here to examine our Venezuela conflict is Professor of Government Mel Goodman. Hi, Mel.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you again. You always call me when the news is bad.
You took the words right out of my mouth. Mel is a professor and senior fellow at the Center of International Policy. He's a professor of government for Johns Hopkins University, a former CIA analyst. He's the author of many books, including Whistleblower at the CIA. And he's a national security columnist, where I go to get great information every week, counterpunch.org. All right, so let's start with some breaking news before we get into Venezuela that has to do with Tellus.
Yes, well, last night, the worst spy in the history of the CIA, which started in 1947-1948, passed away in his jail cell in Cumberland, Maryland. Alger James was responsible for exposing the identity of all of the major Soviet officials that the CIA had recruited and were getting interesting information from. He was in financial trouble, so he essentially just walked into the Soviet embassy and said, I've got some names for you of Soviet agents, of double agents. And the Soviets promised him $1 million, much of which was delivered to him, as well as property in the Soviet Union if he were to decide to get out of the United States and get to the Soviet Union. These 10 agents were all executed very quickly, something that alarmed Ames because he felt now the CIA counterintelligence people would get to him. But it still took them 3 or 4 years. And it was typical, from my experience at the CIA, that whenever there was a potential for a spying or espionage incident, the CIA would expect that it was an FBI agent, and when there was a reverse, an FBI agent who was working for the Soviets, the FBI always pursued the CIA. So that's why you had Robert Hansen, the FBI agent who was allowed to conduct his espionage over a 10-year period because the FBI was looking at the CIA for the victim. And the CIA took much too long to capture Alger James because he was spending money on a wild basis, driving around the parking lot of the CIA in a Jaguar that he paid for with cash and living in a new home that he paid for with $500,000, again, in cash. So when he was finally caught, the CIA was left without any CIA recruits from the Soviet Union. And these included some recruits who were giving very good information on Russian technical achievements in the military area. These were very serious exposes of very important Soviet agents. So it's a reminder of the importance of counterintelligence, to be able to guard your own secrets, to guard your own people, to explore possible compromises of the system. And I worry about this now because under the Trump administration, you have amateurs, really, in charge of the intelligence community. You have an amateur who's the director of national intelligence, Gabbard. You have an amateur who is in charge of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Ratcliffe. And the biggest danger in terms of national security is the deputy chief of staff on the Trump's senior level, a man by the name of Stephen Miller, who I think has compromised counterintelligence and also is the leading voice for using the military in Venezuela, which we did a couple days ago on early on Saturday morning. So that leads us directly into the Venezuelan situation, which is a danger on all fronts. It's a danger in terms of the illegal use of force, ignoring the Congress before conducting this warfare, even though the Trump administration says they were involved in law enforcement. I think when you have 150 aircraft in the air flying from numerous bases in the Caribbean and the United States itself, you're not dealing with law enforcement. You're dealing with covert action, and the whole situation involving regime change. And when you look at regime change, look at the history of it. It's pretty much all negative. Every example I can think of, starting with Eisenhower in Iran in 1953, when we overthrew the government of Mossadegh, which led to the installation of the Shah of Iran, who was a terrible leader, who was himself eventually overthrown in the Khomeini Revolution in 1979. Look at Guatemala in 1954, which led to a very notorious regime under the effort to change the regime. And then in 1959, we were involved in the assassination attempt against Lumumba, because he was a leftist leader who we thought would work with the Soviet Union. By overthrowing him and getting him out of the way, this led to the installation of the worst tyrant in the history of Africa, Mobutu, who ruled for several decades. And then when you think over the years, look at all the years we spent trying to overthrow Castro, which culminated in one sense in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, which was one of the greatest failures in the history of the CIA. But the Eisenhower administration tried to get rid of Castro. The Kennedy administration tried to get rid of Castro. The Johnson administration tried to get rid of Castro. And the government that Castro left behind is still in power. And now you have our Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who is also our National Security Advisor and our National Archivist, and actually the Acting Director of the Agency for International Development, which barely exists, making noises that suggest we're going to use the military in Cuba. This is an outrageous use of power. And we're talking about an administration led by someone who wants the Nobel Peace Prize, who's used military force in the, just in the past year in Syria, in Iran, in Nigeria, in Yemen, and now in Venezuela, followed by the threats to Greenland that we're going to seize Greenland because we need it for national security purposes. And even Mexico has come up on his radar screen as a potential site for the use of military power against the drug cartels. So this is an extremely dangerous situation. It has nothing to do with restoring democracy in Venezuela, which the Trump administration was using as a justification for the use of force. And what we're learning now is about the oil holdings. Venezuela has the largest reserves of oil in the world, which is stunning. But what people don't think about or don't realize is this oil is considered extra heavy in its components, its makeup of the petroleum. That means it's difficult to recover the oil, and to do so, the cost is very high. So the idea that American oil companies are going to invest in Venezuela now, where you have so much instability and uncertainty and chaos, I think is incredibly far-fetched. Now, there is one oil company that has stayed on the ground in Venezuela, and that's Chevron. So Chevron will be in a position, really, to exercise a great deal of power over the oil industry as long as the United States is going to contend that we're going to control Venezuela, that we're going to do it for the long term, that more military power may be involved, and we're going to decide who the oil should be sold to. So this is an incredible seizure of power that suggests not regime change. And here it's something new. It's regime control. The thugs who were still in power with Maduro, when Maduro and his wife were captured, are still positioned in high-level positions within Maduro's cabinet, Maduro's government. We haven't touched these people. We've written off the democratic opposition, particularly Machado, who won a Nobel Peace Prize for her work in Venezuela and trying to lead a revolution. But apparently Trump wrote her off even before the military invasion because he felt she should have announced immediately that she wouldn't take the Nobel Peace Prize. She should give it to, of course, Donald Trump. So we're in a time of tremendous uncertainty. We don't know where this is going. Venezuela, I think, is going to have a period of violence and a period of repression. They're going to skirt economic or come right up to the level of economic ruin. And what Trump has done, essentially, by making this imperialist, colonialist seizure, is signal to Vladimir Putin in Russia that what you're doing in Ukraine is fine. And signaling, I think, to Xi Jinping in China that if you want to make your move on Taiwan, now would be a good time to do it. Because Trump has said in the new national security strategy, which came out last month, that he's interested in an old-fashioned spheres of influence policy in which the United States would be dominant, the hegemon for the Western Hemisphere, that China could be the leader in the Indo-Pacific, and that Russia could be the leader in Central and Eastern Europe. So I see nothing but greater global uncertainty in the near term, and I think things are going to get worse before they get worse. And I hate to have such a gloomy message. At the beginning of the new year, we were counting on things maybe to move in a different direction, but I think this is the reality that we're all dealing with.
All right, thank you for that. And we're listening to Melvin Goodman. He's telling us a little bit about some of the impacts of the current crisis from Venezuela, and we're sort of going around the world and learning about past coup attempts. Well, you mentioned that Russia taking over Ukraine. Do you think that Europe has to worry that after Ukraine falls that they're next?
Well, the Europeans are concerned with that, particularly the Eastern Europeans, the Czechs, the Poles, less so the Hungarians, because the leader of Hungary, Orban, is in the Russian camp. Certainly the Baltic states are worried, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. But there's a very important West European state in NATO, and that's Germany. And Germany clearly has changed its defense funding. They've increased significantly their money appropriated to the military, and they are deeply concerned. And the idea that Trump is moving into Venezuela and moving in the direction of seizing power in the Western Hemisphere, particularly South America, is very worrisome to them. And they know that they can't really resist any Russian further encroachments without United States support. Zelensky's going to have enough trouble in Ukraine dealing with a military situation that will be devoid of U.S. intelligence support and military support. So this is a very crucial time. And frankly, I see signs of real war fatigue in Ukraine. I don't know how they can continue to go along with what they're doing. They're a country of about 30 to 40 million people up against a nuclear armed power like Russia that has a population of about 140 million. And obviously Putin doesn't care how many people are killed or become casualties in this confrontation. He keeps throwing more people into battle. So it's a deplorable situation, and Trump has sort of signaled his intentions with, again, the national security strategy, because he hasn't identified Russia or China as our chief adversary. He's identified the European Union as our chief adversary. So now he's really separated the United States in a geopolitical way from the European powers. And he, in talking about seizing Greenland, Greenland is administered by a NATO country, Denmark. He's threatening to divide the NATO alliance, which kept the peace in Europe since the late 1940s, in a way that alters American geopolitical policy. And it's very dangerous for our short-term and long-term interests. And I hope there is enough public awareness of what is taking place to realize how dangerous this is. But what I worry about is the U.S. traditional support for the use of military. And I think of Richard Nixon's second term victory in 1972, even though he was fighting a very unpopular war, amazing protests against Vietnam like we had never seen before on foreign policy. And then in George W. Bush lied to get us into war in Iraq with phony arguments about nuclear weapons in Iraq's inventory. The war was, again, very unpopular, but he was reelected in 2004. So I don't know if the country is paying attention to the seriousness of this. And when you see the decline of mainstream media in this country, we really only have one or two major newspapers. The New York Times remains a major newspaper, and the Wall Street Journal has very good reporting. But my own hometown paper, the Washington Post, is moving further to the right as Jeff Bezos accumulates more power in how the Washington Post will present news stories. So these are very difficult times.
All right, once again, just to really remind people, you're listening to WSLR and WBPV, and Mel Goodman is with us today. Mel Goodman, we talked about really the elephant in the room, which is oil here, and how does OPEC respond to this?
Well, OPEC can't respond too strongly because the price of oil right now is way down. It's about $60 a barrel. And for companies to invest more in Venezuela to get more oil out of the ground, and as I say, this is extra heavy oil, which is very expensive to recover and requires a lot of expertise, you need oil selling at least $80 to $85 a barrel. So there are a lot of reasons why oil companies wouldn't come into Venezuela. So that increase in production is really unneeded right now because of the global economic markets. The United States is, for all practical purposes, almost self-sufficient in oil anyway. We're the largest producer in the world. Venezuela has the largest oil reserves in the world. So I don't know what OPEC can do. They can try to increase production, but that would just drive down the price even further and make oil companies less willing to come into Venezuela. But again, I don't know why any American company, particularly, say, someone like ExxonMobil, would come into Venezuela when I think the short-term prospects are for repression and violence and chaos and discontinuity. I can't see a favorable or optimistic scenario that would allow an oil company executive to say, yeah, we're prepared to take the advice from Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, who's made it clear that this is going to be a long-term process of U.S. control and U.S. Leadership dealing with the Venezuelan population. I would think these oil companies that are very careful about taking on risk, and risk analysis points to the fact that this is not a favorable investment opportunity or scenario that they're facing.
So, Mel, the Donroe Doctrine, you said, does help Russia Does it help China?
Well, I think it does, because what he's signaling in reframing the Monroe Doctrine to the Donner Doctrine, and I can talk about the Roosevelt corollary to that, to the Monroe Doctrine, that's very important. He's signaling a sphere of influence, old 19th century approach to international relations. So I think if China had any interest in using military force against Taiwan, I think their intelligence analysts would tell them that the United States would not move to defend Taiwan. And really, to me, I don't think Trump wants anything to do with future crises in Europe or the Indo-Pacific, for that matter. He wants to concentrate on the Western Hemisphere, which is kind of ironic, because when you think about it, the United States is the most secure national power in the world. East and west, they have two oceans. North and south, they have two very friendly neighbors, Canada and Mexico. But he's worked to irritate both the Canadians and the Mexicans, but he considers himself the hegemon of the Western Hemisphere. And yesterday in a speech that I heard that he gave, he doesn't understand the American public, which has not supported what he's doing. And clearly you have MAGA interests, his own strong following, who don't like this use of force in Venezuela. He campaigned on the prospects of America First to clear up the American domestic situation. He's appointed people who can't really run the American economy or the American society. These are the most clownish and amateurish people I've seen in key positions in the history of the United States. But he wants to be the king of the Western Hemisphere. He's made that clear. So he's told Putin, in a way, do what you're doing. I'm not going to do anything about it. And he signaled to Xi Jinping, you have a free reign in the Indo-Pacific. All you have to do is acknowledge that I'm totally in control of the Western Hemisphere. China could care less about the Western Hemisphere. I mean, they've made investments there. And the Venezuelans have some debt in relationship to China. But China isn't going to go to bat for Venezuela. Russia isn't going to go to bat for Venezuela. And to complicate matters even further, the United States just seized an oil tanker that was flying a Russian flag, and we don't know what that will lead to, but Russia's been very quiet. So the global community, along with our own domestic community, really don't have a way of dealing with Donald Trump. It's clear the Democratic Party can't decide on a policy. They have very weak leadership, Schumer in the Senate and Jeffries in the House. They have some important leaders, but they don't really have a national voice. People like Chris Murphy of Connecticut or Jamie Raskin of Maryland or Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, Adam Schiff of California. But they're not the leaders of their party. And meanwhile, you have someone like Marco Rubio, who has a case against Cuba. I think he's always wanted to have something to do with overthrowing the Cuban government. His parents came here in the 1950s before the Castro revolution, and Rubio built his following, his prominence, as you know, down in Florida, on Cuban exiles and refugees, and now Venezuelan exiles and refugees. What was stunning to me is when he was confirmed by the Senate, 99-0, obviously he was in no position to vote, that no one raised the issue of the danger of putting Rubio in a position that he was running the Department of State, and now he's running the National Security Agency. But the real villain to me in all of this, in addition to Donald Trump, is Stephen Miller, who's the deputy chief of staff, who I think is a madman when it comes to American use of military power. He gave an interview the other day in which he lectured Jake Tapper of CNN about the real world. The real world relies on strength and power and force, and that's been the iron law of international relations since the beginning of time. This is frightening language, and you have to wonder, where in the hell are we headed?
All right, Mel, we're just flat out of time. We're going to just leave it there. I'm going to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. It's always my pleasure. Maybe you'll call me sometime when there's some good news to talk about, but I don't see that happening in the short term.
Well said. And this has been Steve Norris reporting for WSLR and WBPV.
Medical groups challenged to vaccine policy change move forward. Several major medical organizations can move forward with their lawsuit challenging policies adopted under U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. that they say will lower vaccination rates, a federal judge ruled this week. U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy in Boston rejected arguments by lawyers for President Donald Trump's administration that the groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, lack legal standing to pursue the case because they could not show they were harmed by the policies. The lawsuit seeks to invalidate all votes cast since June by a vaccine advisory panel whose members were selected by Kennedy after he fired all 17 independent experts who had previously served on the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Kennedy founded the anti-vaccine group Children's Health Defense before becoming the head of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Murphy, an appointee of Democratic President Joe Biden, said the plaintiffs raised a plausible claim that the panel's makeup is now skewed to vaccine skeptics who were appointed solely because of their views aligned with Kennedy's. These facts, as alleged, are sufficient to plausibly suggest the committee is neither fairly balanced nor free of appropriate influence or inappropriate influence, Murphy said. As the result, he said the plaintiffs could proceed with their claims that the new ACIP composition does not comport with the Federal Advisory Committee's Act requirements that such panels be fairly balanced and not inappropriately influenced by the appointing official. The ruling came a day after U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cut the number of vaccines it recommends every child receive, a sweeping change that advanced one of Kennedy's longstanding goals. Kennedy has long promoted the view, contrary to scientific evidence, that many vaccines routinely administered to children cause harm, and public health experts have warned his efforts in government are likely to expose a growing number of youth to preventable diseases. The medical groups first sued in July and have expanded their lawsuit since then, though it does not currently address CDC's Monday action. The plaintiffs also include the American College of Physicians, the American Public Health Association, and the Infectious Diseases Society of America. They argue that Kennedy in May unlawfully directed the CDC to remove its recommendation for COVID-19 shots for pregnant women and children from its vaccination schedules. The reconstituted ACIP panel in September voted in favor of the COVID-19 shots being administered only through shared decision-making with healthcare provider, essentially calling for patients to consult their doctors first, a process the medical groups say is time-consuming and would lead to lower vaccination rates. The CDC adopted that as a recommendation for pediatric and adult patients in October, effectively withdrawing its previous broad guidance on COVID vaccines be available to anyone in the U.S. who wanted one. The medical groups say that the advisory panel was unlawfully reconstituted and that all the votes it has taken since the Kennedy-driven shakeup would be voided, including more recent ones, such as the vote in December, to remove the broad recommendation that all newborns receive a hepatitis B vaccine. Should a Bible verse be included in a letter from the state's Department of Education? Some families say it violates the separation of church and state, so they were surprised when they received a letter from Education Commissioner Anastasio Kamoutsas, quoting Proverbs 22:6. The state's DOE has not responded to requests for comment on the letter that was sent prior to the winter break. Denise Menstez Taylor received the email from the state's Education Commissioner before winter break. Addressed to Florida's parents, the letter started out by thanking private and homeschool families, which Mestanzas Taylor is. But she says that she got to the third paragraph, she said. It listed a Bible verse, Proverbs 22:6, about guiding our children on the right path. I'm paraphrasing, but it just struck me as kind of odd to see a Bible verse in a letter from the DOE. Mestas Taylor says her family is Christian, but she firmly believes in secular education. On the other side, Tampa Bay Christian homeschool families disagreed, saying the following is a statement from Misty Sosa. It is refreshing to see a public official acknowledge parents' God-given rights and responsibilities regarding the education and raising of children. I would submit that excluding Christianity from the public is not a neutral position, Sosa said. Christianity from the public is not a neutral position, Sosa said. It puts one religion above all. Yes, as a Christian, I understand that we